Welcome to today's episode of On the Rocks. In line with the theme of technology we've been focusing on this year, today I chat with John Mortensen, Global Chief Technology Officer for Enterprise Asset Management for IFS, a massive software company that develops and delivers enterprise software with industry-specific platforms. On today's episode, we cover what is enterprise asset management and why the heck is it related to mining? And John also shares insights on why technology adoption in mining doesn't trickle down from major mining companies to smaller ones or exploration companies, or at least it doesn't appear to be. This conversation also delves into the balance between maintenance and production, a really interesting challenge at operating mine sites where maybe using the right technology can truly help. John is Australian and has been living in Canada for the last 10 years. He holds a degree in geomechanical engineering from the University of New South Wales, as well as a master's degree in geographical information systems. As global CTO for enterprise asset management, John is responsible for setting the vision and direction of asset management at IFS. His software journey started over 30 years ago within the local government utility space, which is where he gained an appreciation for asset-intensive businesses with huge service deliverables and constrained revenue streams. As you'll hear in today's discussion, John is passionate about improving the reliability and availability of the assets that drive business outcomes in mining. So pour a glass of whatever you're drinking, and let's dive in. Well, John, welcome to On the Rocks. We're really excited to have you on here today to talk about some really cool topics. Are you drinking anything special for today's episode?
Well, I don't know if you'd call it special, but it's Sparrow's Fart here in Vancouver, so I'm on my breakfast smoothie.
Okay.
And these are reasonably tasty, but, you know, we're going to be talking about mining today, and I was actually thinking about this breakfast smoothie, and I think there's to get this into my glass, you're actually mining from 30 different types of mines.
Really?
To get a breakfast smoothie into a glass. And that's, you know, the sand that you've got to mine to make the glass with,
mm-hmm.
but the copper that goes into your blender to make the whole thing go round, all the bits and pieces for extracting the fruit and everything else, everything that you do comes out of the mining industry at the very, very beginning, including things like potash to make the fruit grow.
Yep.
And so I thought, yeah, it's reasonable.
that works great. And I'm sure you used ice to make the smoothie cold, so therefore it is technically on the rocks as well, I think.
It is, yes. You've got to do the ice or else it's really unpalatable.
Right, absolutely. Well, I am, as someone who started her career at IBM dealing with big systems and big technology, I'm really super interested in our conversation today. And I wonder if you might kick it off just by telling us a little bit about IFS and how did a company like IFS and a person like yourself end up working in the mining industry? Because I think most folks, when they think people who are in mining, they don't think about like a solution or a company like IFS.
It's interesting because they ought to.
Right.
I'll answer your question back the front because I'll tell you how I got into the mining industry first and then how, as a software company, what it is we do and how we got into the mining space as well. I'm actually a geomechanical engineer. Yeah. Which means I understand tectonic plate movements. But when I went to university, I went to the University of New South Wales in Sydney, Australia. One of the subjects I did was mining engineering. So I had to start down there. My uncle was a mine manager for a coal mine. My uncle ran a platinum mine in South Africa. So mining is sort of in the blood somewhere along the way. So it's always a favorite topic. And having been down mines and open pits and things like that, the stories that I could tell are probably going to keep you all awake at night. but a company like ours, we have some unique propositions that we bring to the table. We have a single platform that covers not just financials and ERP, but we also have enterprise asset management. And we're building ourselves into asset performance management and asset investment planning. And that really plays in asset-intensive industries and people who have big issues and big problems we can solve. And that, one of the reasons we can do that is that we're sort of very agile. So we've come into it because of our ability to deal with asset-intensive industries and our understanding of the sorts of infrastructure that has to be put in place for these industries to work with. And we've been around for 40 years. We started, you know, managing maintenance on nuclear power plants in Norway. Over time, those sorts of businesses enabled us to expand our footprint into many other areas. So we've ended up with the largest miner for iron ore in Europe, LKAB. They're huge. They produce 80% of the iron ore that's produced in Europe itself. And for an Australian, I didn't even know that other people made iron ore because Australia is iron ore.
Right.
But it is really a remarkable thing when you think about a company that started in Scandinavia, in Sweden and Norway, and because of these sorts of extractive industries that they have as well, it was a natural way for us to move in.
Very cool. And for folks who may not be aware or who may not be familiar, like, what does asset management mean from a systems perspective? Like, what does that look like and feel like to somebody?
Yes, that's a really interesting question, because that definition is in a state of flux today. When I woke up into the world, asset management was doing maintenance.
Right.
And it was just making sure things worked. Mm-hmm. But we went through a reliability phase where it was making sure your assets worked reliably and could actually help you stay ahead of the game when you were out doing whatever it is. Because in mining industry particularly, the key is to keep everything operating all the time.
Right.
Because at any moment, when something stops, you end up with problems. You end up with a problem that you're not producing, and that hits revenue and your margin. And when it breaks down, it's probably in a remote area and you just have to get somebody in there to fix it. It becomes expensive. Some of the logistical supply chain issues that you have in Africa and Australia and even here where I am in Canada up in the far north, it takes a long time to get bits and pieces in to fix it. So it becomes more of a life cycle management journey. Choosing the right assets at the beginning of that journey becomes the first thing in an asset management process. What do I buy? Do I buy the cheapest thing that does it? Or do I buy a thing that is going to be slightly more expensive, but I can keep it ticking over and its uptime working for longer as we go through? And then at the other end, is it going to be able to be something that I can dispose of profitably, or do I need to just dump it and create waste, which is not what we're trying to do in this 21st century world? So asset management is that entire process. We tend to break it up into three parts: enterprise asset management, which is a nice moniker, but it covers all that maintenance, and it covers logistical supply chains that's behind that and making sure you have all the bits and pieces wherever you need it. But there's another component of it that sits out there in the world, which is asset investment planning. What do I need to buy 5 years' time, 10 years' time to achieve my objectives? And then there's asset performance management. How do I monitor those assets effectively so that I can forecast when it's going to have a problem and I can prepare myself for that? So very broad definition, changing. We had a new standard come in 10 years ago. It's going to be re-released this year, ISO 55000. There's a whole bunch of sub standards that go with that, 55001, 2, 3, 10, 11, 12, 13, which is all about how to make all these things come together. And you can't get what you need today without systems like we produce to make sense of all the data that you've got, to be able to pull it all together so you can make the right decisions at the right time to make sure that you are maintaining that one number one goal, which is uptime, particularly in the mining industry.
Yeah, it must. I mean, we, of course, at Prospector deal with data in a very different way, right? Textual data and that side. But I mean, from folks that operate in your side of the space, I mean, just the sheer growth and the volume of data that systems have to be able to manage, right? Because everything now has a sensor. Everything is connected. Everything is trying to transmit data, and it all has to be integrated. And I mean, like, the complexity of those systems, I would imagine, has grown tremendously over the last few years.
Yes. So I hate the word complexity, because what we're trying to do is make it less complex in doing it. The right. environment we work in becomes much more complex, and the more complex the environment sure. we work in becomes, the more that we have to start thinking about how do we simplify this so that we are not drowning in the data. How do we bring together different streams of data to give us new insights into those things? And it's using that data effectively from the sensors, from your maintenance records, from your finance system, from your production systems. They all have a play in what you're doing, and bringing that together and trying to look at it in a way that we can simplify it, help you make the decisions that you need to do, help you do your processes that you need to do in the most effective and efficient manner, and being data-driven as much as we can.
Yeah, and I think this is one area we talk a lot on this podcast about the poor mining industry. We kind of say it's behind the times quite a bit, right, in a lot of different ways. But especially at operating mines and larger ones in particular, I think this is where we might need to challenge that assumption that mining is behind the times. Like, large companies have, you know, become very advanced with these types of technologies and systems, right? But it doesn't seem to kind of trickle downstream to the smaller companies or the earlier stage companies, maybe out to the service industries. Why do you think that is? You see autonomous trucks and ghost mines and, like, you know, completely remote operating systems, but then you go to other places where it's like, you know, they're not automated at all, or there's no cloud-based infrastructure. Like, why do you see such a big gap?
It's a fascinating question. And I often try to think about what it is that makes a big company different to a smaller company. And when you think of a company, and I'll pull out BHP as an example here, they're investing in getting to a net zero situation, and they are working with Komatsu and Caterpillar to come up with battery operated trucks. 40% of their ESG emissions comes from those big trucks. You said autonomous trucks, all the autonomous trucks. And they're wanting to replace those diesel trucks with batteries, so 800-ton batteries. They can afford to do that sort of thing.
Yeah.
They've got deep pockets. They make huge revenue, and they can say, we're going to be net zero by this date, and we're going to get there. Then you have LKAB I was talking about earlier on. LKAB, who is a customer of ours, they want to be carbon neutral by 2045. So they're going down this whole digital footpath to get there. But again, I mentioned it earlier on, they're one of the largest mining companies based in Europe. They're in 14 countries, I think. Quite a huge operation. But when we start going down the hill slightly to the smaller players and the mid-sized players, they can't get those same levels of efficiency at an affordable level as somebody like a BHP or a Tinto and LKAB, a Vale, whatever. So they don't have as much flexibility in doing things. The margins they're working on are tighter if they're going to be selling competitively, for example. They're having more difficulty optimizing their use of their capital. Mm-hmm. And so they are not investing in a lot of things because they're trying to play a different game.
Yeah.
And to me, those are the players that we can really help, those mid-tier players, mm-hmm. because I was talking before about single platforms doing a lot of things.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we can do is, you know, help optimize. Supply chain, we can help optimize their labor and their usage. We use artificial intelligence to do that sort of thing. We provide tools that enable them to gather all the data that they've got, bring it through what is effectively a data hub to help them make these sorts of decisions. And we try to keep it simple. These are instead of going out and trying to work with big companies to put 800-ton batteries in there, it's like, how can we reduce stuff in a different way? Can we use a digitalization program to get there to do that? And they're so busy trying to make that margin, optimize that capital, that they're not thinking about a whole bunch of things because that's not their primary focus. Their primary focus is to try to get that margin. And there is a thought process that often goes that if I spend money in doing this, then that's going to take away from my margin. I'm going to be less profitable because I'm still having to compete against the big players when it comes to the price side of it.
Yeah.
I don't know if that makes any sense at all. I mean, I just babbled that out at you.
Yeah, no, I think it makes a lot of sense. And even when I've talked to folks on like the technology innovation side too, I think it goes hand in hand with also when mining companies have money to invest and is it CapEx or OpEx, right? And a lot of times there are key points in the development and design of a mine and then the operation of the mine where if they're making large equipment purchases or something, having solutions that can be wrapped in with those other key decision points, I think is how folks think about it. When in fact, there is a lot that can be done in between those big checks, right? That can improve, you know, the way that the mine is operating and therefore the, you know, the improve the margin, make the margin bigger, not, you know, see it as a sunk cost, basically.
Yeah, and it's how you view the investments you make to do that. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people say, I invest in software like IFS,
yeah,
and it's going to cost me X number of dollars a year. And that's a cost that's coming into the business. Whereas the larger players tend to think of that as, I'm buying this sort of software as an investment. Mm-hmm. And the investment that I'm making in that software has got a value. And right. That value is going to end up on my bottom line. But I've got to make the investment. I've got to spend the time putting it together. And then I've got to be utilizing it appropriately. And therefore, I'm getting a return on an investment rather than it's a sunk cost. Because once you start saying cost, people just go,
yeah,
I'm not making a lot of money this year. And the year they are making money, their shareholders are going, give it to me.
Right. Yeah, absolutely.
I'm one of those shareholders in some companies. where's my money?
Well, I wonder if that also is part of the tension that you see between, you know, maintenance and production. You know, there's that delicate balance between maintaining equipment for production efficiency and, you know, the emerging importance of predictive maintenance and monitoring. But anytime you are taking anything offline to maintain it, you are impacting production, right?
Yes. So the idea is to try to reduce that impact. And that's where having all of this infrastructure around you that you were talking about before, the IoT, the sensors and everything else, and then having things like we provide data hubs, maintenance processes, predictability, and so on, is if you know and can predict when something is going to happen or a window in which it's going to happen, you can then sort of say, I'm going to do something about this before it happens, because if I just let it happen, that's a huge cost.
Yeah.
But if I can say, wacko, I know that's going to be a problem. I can make sure I've got all the bits and pieces I need to deal with the problem I'm anticipating. So I have that on hand. I can say, I'm going to take that offline for a shorter period of time, a much shorter period of time. I can negotiate a time with operations. They can prepare themselves for it not being available. I can get the thing done quickly and get that back operational very quickly. So I'm still going to have time down where I've got a production impact. Mm-hmm. But what I can do is say that impact is going to be minimal on what you're doing. And this is an example from a little while ago. But you know those big trucks? We're talking about them before, the big autonomous trucks.
Yeah.
Well, I was up in North Alberta a couple of years ago, and I look at those big trucks on the news and I go, they're big trucks. But you don't understand the scale of them till you actually stand next to them. And I'm not exactly short, but the lug nuts on those wheels are higher than my head.
Yeah.
So you've got these huge tires. And you stand by that truck and you just think about the tire because it's there.
Yeah.
And you go, okay, That tire costs anywhere between $100,000 and $250,000.
Mm-hmm.
And people know that it takes 6 months to get one of those into places. So northern Alberta, not too difficult. Take it to Ghana and you've got a 6 month wait for one of those things to turn up. But you've also got $250,000 tied up and it's there. So if I can start predicting the probability of a failure of a tire, and I can get that supply chain working, I can minimize what I have on site, but have an effective amount of it ready for when one of these things goes. And that's fairly straightforward. But you think of those big trucks, there's millions of bits and pieces in there. You can put 30, 40 sensors on there. You get oil pressure, you get temperature, you get strain on it. You understand exactly what's going on because those things are really intelligent and you send it through. I've forgotten where I'm going with this, but I was getting excited.
Start talking about big truck tires and it's just...
Yeah, I got excited on big truck tires, but I get excited on the big trucks. But those things, when they're in production, can carry, depending on what we're mining, anything between $50,000 and $100,000 worth of stuff that's just been mined.
Right.
Up to $1 million worth. So every hour that it's off the road is bad. But if I'm bringing all that data in, not processing it, multivariate, so many, many pieces of data, bring it together to do the prediction with, if I can put that through my data hub and then go, this is what I think is going to happen, send that to my enterprise asset management system and say, let's schedule some maintenance for that, let's get the logistics ready for it. I can say to those people, right, we're going to take that truck off. It'll only be 2 hours now rather than 4 weeks. That's a production improvement. Choice is yours. Do you want it to collapse now or do you want it off now or do you want to wait till it collapses in the field and we have to send somebody out there? Then you've got a problem. So this whole predictability for maintenance and the supply chain and everything else has to come together somehow, and that's what we try to bring to the table for these people. And I forgot what the question was with that. I got carried away with the big truck. I'm so sorry.
No, I think it makes complete sense. To me, it's always funny because my car is so smart, right? And my car tells me when I should be doing certain types of maintenance. It has all these little lights that pop up and say, engine or coolant or all these different things. But if I don't listen to the car, I'm still going to have to do that maintenance. It's just going to be highly inconvenient and much more expensive, right? So I, as my husband likes to consistently remind me every time I call him in a panic because I'm worried the car's about to blow up, because I went 2 months past what the car told me that I should schedule some maintenance.
I'm originally from Sydney, Australia, and the example we always use there is you don't want to be the person who breaks down on the Sydney Harbour Bridge and blocks traffic for half a day until the tow truck can come and take you away because everybody driving past you is like, I'm going to kill you.
Exactly. But I think, it's so true. And it's I think, again, for big operating projects, you can kind of understand how all that works. But I think more and more with even on the exploration side, right, like there's really technical equipment that's used. There's and in very remote locations. And it's just as important for some of these like satellite companies or service companies that might be operating in different parts of the space, like because their ability to deliver really impacts the primary, the customer's timeline and being able to meet their plan, right? If you're an exploration company and you're out in the field and you've got 3 months to drill and your drilling company isn't using kind of the technology that supports predictive maintenance on their equipment, like that not only screws up their business, it can screw up your business. Right.
it's not just in the exploration space either. It's actually the operating mines as well. We always think about mining as being these big mining companies, but it's this big mining company and hundreds of thousands of different contractors that get involved in the process, whether it be in exploration where you're getting somebody else to do the hard yards for you and you're paying them on a success basis, or whether you're contracting them in to do something. So you can start thinking about all those sub-supporting industries that do that. So the reason I was up looking at those big trucks was that mines outsource the tire management of the trucks.
Yeah.
In Australia, I work with a Swiss company called TipTop, and they just manage I'm having a mind blank here now, but the rollers that pull things are the conveyors. Mm-hmm. They manage all the conveyors that they have on those sites there. And if the conveyor goes down, the contractor is responsible, but I, as the producer, all of a sudden can't get my stuff to the next stage of the journey. If my tires go, I can't do that. There's so many contractors that get involved that need to be able to manage this. And those large mines, they sometimes build monolithic systems with some of our competitors.
Right.
And then they lose the agility at the next level down. So everybody's having to go buy a new system to help support it because the monolithic system doesn't do it. And so you need to be a little bit agile and say, okay, as one of these supporting contractors, I do this for 57 different mines owned by multiple companies. Maybe I need my own, but I need it also to be able to talk to the monolithic one that the mine has got in place so they know what's happening with their stuff. So again, it's data again, the interrelationship, it's got to be able to move around. But a lot of those contractors, they're working on very thin margins. And again, it's that same conversation we had about cost before. They see it as a cost,
mm-hmm.
but everybody else sees it as an investment. And you need to see it as an investment and understand, what am I going to get out of it? Why is it valuable to me? And why is it valuable to the people I'm supporting? Because
yeah.
I'm part of an ecosystem. And if I fail, then the whole enterprise fails. And it's not just the mine that's going to suffer. It's all the other contractors who have got their bit in the supply chain or the work stream or everything else that gets impacted. You're so right when it comes to, you've got to think of those people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think back to my IBM days when I was in IBM's public sector supply chain management practice, which, you know, made no sense for a geology and government and legal stuff. Double major, early, you know, new grad, but I loved it. I learned so much because I'd never been exposed to anything regarding production or maintenance and supply chain. And the first consulting gig that I had as part of the IBM team was mapping the repair process of the B-52 engine cowling at Tinker Air Force Base out in Oklahoma City. And it was all about how the Air Force and the OEMs maintain, you know, all these massive airplane parts. And the way I was kind of teamed up with an aerospace engineer, because I knew nothing about planes, you know, I was just there to kind of do like the Lean Six Sigma, you know, capturing all the different steps and, you know, inputting the data. But he would teach me why all of these different pieces were important. By every Monday when I showed up, he would have a different plane crash. And he would be like, here is a plane that crashed in this place, and here is why it crashed. Like, this part of the system didn't do its job because this wasn't maintained, or this was, you know, this hadn't been replaced. And it's like, you know, when you think about it, the ways that all of these systems are so integrated, they really are, you know, each piece is fundamental, including like an operational system, right? And managing all the data and the different pieces from, you know, for an operating business. I think it's fascinating when you kind of step back and think about what it takes to put everything in the place that it's supposed to be, when it's supposed to be there, and make sure that it works, right? Like, these systems are incredibly powerful that help you do that.
Right. So I'm going to do an advert here in the middle of it. To anybody who's listening to this podcast who happens to manufacture equipment for mines, our ERP system is designed for you to design, build, and create these assets. But we go one step further because we have all this enterprise asset management in it. It enables you to be able to service that equipment as an OEM. So I make it, I service it. So many people do that. Rolls-Royce is one of the people we do it with. Enables you to go out and provide to the mine sites this sort of equipment, and gives you a way of monitoring it and being responsible for its ongoing maintenance with a relationship. Sorry, I had to throw that out in there because it's a unique differentiator for us.
Yeah, and it's a big expansion of their business, right? If you're able to provide that as a service, and your relationship just doesn't stop at the point of sale, right? Yeah, that's a huge advantage.
That's exactly right. So servitization has become really important right across the board, as particularly mid-sized companies are trying to offload that responsibility what better way of doing it than having manufacturers support you?
No, that's great. Are there any other kind of key walkaway points that you want folks who are listening to think about that they can, you know, take into their workplace of things they could ask for or research or look at that maybe would be of interest?
Yeah, I'd say a key takeaway that I'd like people to walk away with is that systems don't have to be monolithic. Systems can be an investment with a return and a value, that you don't need to go out and replace an enterprise asset management system today, but you should look at some of the ancillary technologies that support that, such as I was talking about data hubs before. Give us a call. Ask about our operational intelligence platform that brings all this stuff together. Ask us about what we can do for your supply chain logistics. But think about all the steps in a process, where they're manual and where they're falling apart, and go, what can I do to remove that component? Do I need to have a human there making a decision in their very, very, very busy day where they won't get up to it straight away? Or could I get away with a system who's going to be autonomous and can help make those decisions, and all I need to do is go yes or no, or even say, just go do it, because you've already worked it out. All I'm going to be able to do is add my human viewpoint to it.
Yeah.
So think about everything that you do in your job and ask, is this something that I could take off my plate so I can concentrate on the bigger things that the human brain and your training has enabled you to bring to the business? Because you have to face it, most of us spend half our time doing paperwork and bureaucracy rather than doing what we were educated to do and do it well.
Yeah, no, I think that's such an important point, because and sometimes people are resistant to technology because they think it's going to, you know, remove their job, right? Or remove, you know, something that they're a real expert at, when in fact, if it's done the right way, it allows you to focus more on that, right? And removes the their stuff off the table.
Yeah, I don't want to be an overpaid clerk.
Yeah,
I want to be able to get into the nitty-gritty of things that I find interesting and that I think bring value from me to the business, which is usually typically something that can't be replaced with technology, because I've got that ability to dig in, get excited, get enthusiastic, get into my job, and not into that whole, okay, here's another 57 forms I need to fill in. I've got to work out how am I going to get that from China to Ghana in less than 6 months, when technology can do it for you much, much faster.
Yeah. Well, with that, we, of course, ask all of our guests the same question at the end of each episode. So if you could just wake up tomorrow and have changed one thing about the mining industry overnight by waving a magic wand, you don't have to work hard at it. You don't have to convince anybody. You just wake up tomorrow, you wave the magic wand, and it's done. What would it be?
Yeah, I've heard you ask other people this question, and I put some thought into it, actually, because I mentioned before about the smoothie and everything else like that and all the mining that goes into it. But somehow mining companies, more than any other industry, are quite often maligned as being rapacious pillagers of the earth's resources. You read any science fiction book from the 1950s onwards, in the last 50, 70 years, and behind every evil story, there's a mining company trying to extract things out of the ground. And it's really quite scary. And to be honest, there are some operators who do fall into that stereotype, but overall, in the industry, they've invested a lot in sustainable and environmentally friendly mining practices. I talked about what BHP was doing in terms of replacing their battery to diesel trucks with battery-operated ones, trying to work on how to make that happen. Talked about LKBs, trying to do that digital transformation. But what you don't see a lot of in the public domain is transparency on how mining companies are doing that sort of thing. So to get back to the nub of the question, what I'd like to see from the mining industry is more transparency in the public domain of verifiable and auditable environmental improvements that don't come across as greenwashing, because I know they're out there doing it.
Yeah.
But in the perception of the man or woman on the street, they're just trying to extract as much as possible. They don't care about the environment. They don't care about this. And I would like them to be able to say and have it easily accessible that actually we are better than that. Mm. That's what I would like to see change, that visualization of what it is we're doing. And if you need to know about that, keep talking to us. Don't just throw that bit in the head. I mean, that was a magic wand, but, you know, it's not going to happen with a magic wand, but we can help.
Absolutely. We like to say we're doing it one podcast at a time. So, awesome. Thanks so much. We'll talk to you soon.
Thank you for listening to the latest episode of On the Rocks. This episode has been sponsored by IFS. To learn more, visit www.ifs.com or follow them on Twitter, LinkedIn, Facebook, Instagram, and YouTube. If you are interested in sponsoring an episode of On the Rocks yourself, please email hello@prospectorportal.com to learn more.